If I bleed tonight, if I am sad tonight, I don't have a job to find. And if I work tonight, if I'm so tired tonight, I'll fall asleep when I'm home, when I'm home. Hey everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Power Slam podcast here on Inside the Ropes. My name is Kenny McIntosh, joined by my mentor, my good friend Finn Martin. Hi Finn, how are you? And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Kenny. I believe we have already said this once, but we will say it again with even more verve. Happy New Year.
It's worth repeating. And I also, the problem is, because we were in that weird time period, I can't remember when I've last podcasted with people, so I'm just kind of, I'm saying Happy New Year just to get it out of the way in case I didn't say it. But if I've said it before, then I'm just reaffirming it. I'm just reaffirming my commitment to you that I hope that you have a Happy New Year period.
Well, Kenny, as a member of the Inside the Ropes team, you know, one of the stars of the Inside the Ropes team, I'm sure it will be a wonderful year for me and for you, and hopefully for all of our listeners and pro wrestling. Is there anyone I've missed out?
No, I think you. We are the world, you know, all that sort of stuff. It's all good. but yeah, the holiday season was very wacky with wrestling. We had Lars Sullivan had done a porno. We've got all the loads of stuff going on that's very random. But
you're right. I mean, it's nice to get back to normal, back into the schedule. You know, you don't know whether you're coming or going, do you, over Christmas and New Year?
I really decided this year, I hate the period between Christmas and New Year. I hate not knowing what day it is. And especially if you do, like, events and stuff, like, it's very hard to, like, get planning on stuff for the following year, because everybody kind of bunkers down about mid-December and they don't really get going again until mid-January.
Yeah, I do know what you mean. And most people went back to work yesterday. And I mean, not that we ever stopped, of course. You and I, we never stop working, do we, Kenny? Ever.
But 7 days a week.
Most people went back to work yesterday. And hey, it feels good to be getting back to normal. But you're right. And I imagine over the next week or so, all those people who've had a bit of time off will be available to communicate with you again and make decisions about what's going to happen.
That's the hope. That's to get things going. I do actually want to say something I'm going to try and say every week, because we don't really do it, and a lot of podcasts do it, and we should do it, is if you are listening to us on Apple Podcasts or whatever, give us a review, a 5-star review if you feel so obliged. If you love the podcast, give it 5 stars. If you don't like it, just don't leave a review. you know, if you get something nice to say, great. If you get nothing nice to say, don't say anything at all. But leave us a review. We would love to get our 5-star reviews going up. I know we get thousands of you to listen every single week. So if you've not done so and you are listening on Apple, then give us a 5-star review if you feel so inclined.
Listen, we're not above disabling comments, are we, Kenny? We're not above that.
No, not whatsoever. We're not above deleting comments and then DMing someone to warn them they need to upload a positive comment. We have time. We're self-employed. Anyway, but it's been a weird year, a weird new year, sorry. And one of the weird stories that it did come up last year, I think we did mention it then, but it seems that he is serious, as Hulk Hogan has been posting photos on his Twitter account of him with like a full white beard. He's talking about how he wants to have a match at WrestleMania 36. There's a photo that he put up with him with a full white beard that said, "They said 4 months lightweight, then 6 months I could train slowly again after back surgery number 10. But it's 7 weeks, 4 days, my maniacs can see I'm on the grind with my pizump on, brother." That's P-I-Z-U-M-P, pizump. I mean, Plizzies, P-L-I-Z-E-A-S-E. WrestleMania is right around the corner, brother. Hollywood HH for life.
He needs to have a match with Johnny Swinger on Impact Wrestling. That's what he needs. You know, they're both from the same era.
So you're the sort of realistic person in the room. Is there any way, any environment, any kind of match you could envision Hulk Hogan? Because, you know, you do get the idea that he hates the idea that his last match was in TNA.
Yes.
So he really wants to write that wrong. He wants to just say his last match was in WWE at WrestleMania. Is there anything that you think he would even be able to do? Is there any match type that maybe people aren't thinking of that could facilitate Hogan? Or do you think it's just a complete no-go?
I mean, maybe he could be a participant in a six-man match. I don't think they would allow him to take any bumps. I mean, there again, you go back, you know, to 2010... We had Bret Hart back. He couldn't take any blows to the head. He couldn't take any bumps. I mean, obviously, that comeback was not a success, but he got to have his comeback. And now if they could do it for Bret, maybe they could do it for Hogan as well, where he's not taking any flat back bumps. I mean, I'm sure he can throw a punch, and there's things he could do in a match. I mean, look at Big Show on Raw this week. We'll be talking about that in a moment. He didn't do a whole lot in that. Most people had to do the bumping for him. And that wasn't really that noticeable unless you were looking for it, which I was as soon as I saw him walk up the steps and I could see that his knees were shot. So with Hogan in a WrestleMania six-man or an eight-man match, I think he could do something in there. He could, you know, he could get a pop and maybe he could do a body slam. I don't think he can seriously do the leg drop. I don't think they would want him taking any bumps of any kind, but I think in the right type of match with the right opponents, then they could essentially do all the work for him. I mean, you know, even in Hogan's prime, a lot of people did the work for him. Certainly now in 2020, when Hogan's, what was he born in? 53, wasn't he? So what will he be now? Will he be 60, 66? Will he be? Kenny?
Yeah, I think he's 67 in August.
That's right, yeah, born in August 53. So, I mean, you know, he's 66. I mean, we all know who he is. We all know what he's done for the business. We all know, I think he's genuine about wanting this one last match at WrestleMania to go out with a bang. And I thought he did well when he was opposing Ric Flair on Raw in the promos. I thought that was the best work he's done really since...
His 2014 comeback.
He was kind of forgiven to an extent, wasn't he, in 2018 when he was allowed back, even though a lot of the audience hadn't forgiven him and still hasn't. But I thought he did well in the run-up to the Crown Jewel show where he's doing the, you know, the square-offs with Ric Flair. So I think he could be valuable in terms of promoting a match there. It's obviously going to get a lot of play because a lot of the people who write for the websites and the newscasters and all the people in the media know Hulk Hogan. It's an easy story and he's really good with media, or at least he once was. So, I mean, it's something that's a nice story. It's an easy story to tell. So I think he could do something, yeah, but not a singles match, and certainly not a singles match with Vince McMahon, which I believe is his preferred option. At least that's what he said in the interview for the LA Times a couple of months back. He has said that he would like to do a match with Vince. That's not going to happen. But I think Hogan could definitely do something and be an asset in a six or an eight-man match. What do you think, Kenny?
I can't imagine any world where he could do a leg drop. Like, I don't know what kind of back surgery he could have that would make that be possible. But, yeah, I mean, if you like Hulk Hogan, you're going to just want him to go away. Sorry, if you dislike Hulk Hogan, you're just going to never want any part of this. I think for somebody like me who did grow up a big Hulk Hogan fan, I would like to see, like, a last moment for him in some way, because I think he does deserve it. For his contribution to wrestling, generally, like, I just think you don't want the last moment of a guy's career to be a crappy, you know, high big boot that only reaches somebody's knee on a house show in Birmingham for TNA. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's no way to go out. That's no way for, you know, Spike Dudley to go out. Never mind Hulk Hogan. So, yeah. But you know, the time might have passed him by. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, like you say, the stuff with Flair, people were into it. People were more into it than I thought they were going to be. But I just don't know who you would put him up against or what the story would be. But And I think it also has to be something where the heels are not like... Like, I don't think people would want to see Hulk Hogan beating up the Authors of Pain.
No.
Like, it would have to be like a kind of... He would have to be involved, but not like pinning any sort of big player.
Absolutely. I mean, to me, Dolph Ziggler would be ideal on the other team because Dolph does those ridiculous bumps. That'd work really well with Hogan. I mean, you couldn't really take the match seriously if Hogan's in there. But I mean, you know, it's a nostalgia exercise. It's putting smiles on people's faces. So, I mean, someone like Dolph, who doesn't really matter anymore, he's somebody who could go in there and take some ridiculous bumps for the Hulkster. And some other expendable guys, let's face it, there's no shortage of them on the WWE roster. Put them against Hogan. Maybe you could have like a team of old-timers. I'm not sure who. I mean, you could have Nash and Hall there. I mean, I'm not sure whether you'd really want to put all three of them in the ring, but obviously we've got the NWO business. They're going into the Hall of Fame, so it could be an NWO-themed thing.
Yes.
You could do that. That would work as part of the storyline. And I think people would really enjoy seeing that at WrestleMania, because as we know, there's a lot of fans who come back for one night only just to, you know, relive their childhoods or relive the good times or whatever. So to see those guys as the NWO... I'm not quite sure who would be in the ring as the NWO. I think Nash could do something. I'm not so sure about Hall at this point. Not so sure where Sean Waltman's at with his health. So I'm not quite sure how it would work. I don't have all the answers, but I feel like if they can, I feel like they could do something in a multi-man match.
So let's, before we talk about SmackDown and Raw, let's talk about Wrestle Kingdom 14 that took place in Japan this past weekend. We're not going to go into all of the matches, but we'll hit on some kind of bigger stuff and see what we think. I want to ask you first of all about the retirement of Jushin Thunder Liger. You've obviously covered him a lot in the magazines, but how was this as a sort of farewell for him? Do you think that having him in these multi-man matches was a good way to send him off? And
absolutely. Sorry? Right. Yeah, absolutely right. Yes, absolutely.
So talk a little bit more about Liger's kind of like, what is his legacy in pro wrestling, and why do you think this was the right situation for him to go out?
Well, simply because, I mean, I just say firstly that I watched the New Year Dash ceremony where they had Okada and Tanahashi,
Will Ospreay,
you know, the baby faces were all out there, and I thought that was really touching, and they made the point of saying. But like at the dumb shows, Liger wanted to go on first. He wanted to go on early because he recognised that his time was over, and that the real stars were the people who were sticking around, and that they were the ones that people had paid to see. So it was always a very humble guy. He was always somebody who recognised what his role was and had done for many years. Obviously, he was the star of the junior heavyweight division. From, I think it was 1989, he debuted as the character, I think it was. Obviously, he'd wrestled under his real name for many years prior to that. I think it was 31 years he wrestled as Jushin Liger. I think that's correct, Kenny. Can you just look that one up while I'm talking?
I'm looking at it right now. Yeah, you are correct.
Yeah. So, I mean, the ceremony at New Year Dash, which was January 6th, I mean, it was really touching. His wife was there, his son was there, and they had all the wrestlers around the ring. And it was just a really nice, there was no angles, no silliness. It was just pure class. He was out there in full Liger regalia. And there was some talk that he should go out there in a suit, but he wanted to go out there he ended up going out there in his full costume. And, you know, just seeing Tanahashi in tears. And, you know, it almost set me off, Kenny, you know, and that was just illustrated to me how much this guy meant. I used to argue with someone on Power Slam, Ernie Santilli, and he used to say, well, Jushin Liger's overrated. You know, he's no Tiger Mask, you know, Satoru Tsuyama, the first one. He was always a huge fan of the first Tiger Mask. And he would say that, well, Liger's no Tsuyama. And it's like, well, but he had far more longevity. I mean, he was a huge star for three decades under that costume. I mean, I think the first time I ever saw Liger was on WCW TV, maybe about 1991, I think it was. And they were showing some matches from New Japan of him versus Pegasus Kid, Chris Benoit. And I was just like, wow, this guy is so good. And I'd never seen anything like it. And this was all the hype for his... he was going to interface Brian Pillman when they had the... Remember when they had the light heavyweight title, Kenny? That period where the light heavyweight title. And Jushin Liger, I think, beat Pillman for the belt in late December of 91. And then he dropped the belt back to Pillman on the Super Brawl 2 show. In that very famous match they had, which on the official WCW VHS release was heavily edited. It was like a really short version of the match. And for years, people say, oh, the match between Liger and Pillman at Super Bowl was amazing. I was like, really? I watched it. It's that good. And I think there was about half the length of what it was on the night. And WCW had this weird... I've never understood it, where they would edit the matches to fit onto, I think it was a two-hour VHS release. So they would edit things from the pay-per-views. So you'd buy the pay-per-view on VHS at great expense, but it wasn't the complete event. So, I mean, Liger's a guy who got over huge in WCW, ended up working for NXT, doing a match there with Tyler Breeze, wasn't it? One of the takeovers?
Yeah, and I was there live. That's the one time I ever got to see Liger live and in person at TakeOver Brooklyn.
Yeah, I mean, he wrestled everywhere, he wrestled for like all the major Japanese companies, obviously New Japan, but he would wrestle for other companies as well when they had deals, wrestled in Mexico, did stuff in the UK for various promotions. Was a huge draw, a guy that could that you could book on an independent show in America and would always draw. He was somebody who was just like one of the, when you think of him, I mean, obviously, there were much bigger worldwide stars, but he was a guy who was sort of over wherever he went. And he was quite extraordinary when you think about it. There's not that many wrestlers who've got over in as many territories as Liger did, certainly in the modern era.
The thing is, if you see Jushin Thunder Liger at a show, like, it's very easy to get how fun he is, whether you like good wrestling or whether you like wacky costumes and characters. Like, he's just kind of like appeals to pretty much everybody.
Absolutely. I mean, he was, and you know, because of the costume, people at first weren't really taking him seriously, but he was such a great performer that they could not, and he had all these tremendous matches with so many different talents there. He did the Super J Cups, like these tournaments where he'd invite wrestlers from all the different Japanese promotions and American promotions as well, Western promotions as well, into these tremendous tournaments like the original Super J Cup, which was April of 1994. Just one of the most amazing shows ever held, still to this day. And he was like the guy who basically ran the junior heavyweight division multiple time, IWGP junior heavyweight champion throughout the 1990s until he recognized that it was his time to step down and step back and let a new generation come through. He was somebody who was really kind of seen as very selfless and was all about making new stars. And that was very true right to the end, borne out by what I just said about his placement on the cards at the Wrestle Kingdom events and on the New Year Dash show with his ceremony at the start of the event rather than the main event spot, which, you know, no one would have begrudged him had his retirement ceremony at New Year Dash gone on last, but it went on first, and that was just Jushin Liger all over. But yeah, just an incredible flyer who did all these most amazing moves, like the shooting star press and all these amazing flying moves. And then when he realized that he was too old to do them effectively, he modified his style and did a lot more sort of straight wrestling and groundwork so that he wouldn't embarrass himself. He was somebody who was very aware of his limitations, certainly as he got older. And I think to me, he was still really good at the end. I don't think he was ever someone who ever looked... I mean, I'm sure there were some bad matches that he had or some mediocre performances, but generally, he was a guy that could still, everything that he did even towards the end still looked decent. And I think he really went out not on top, because he went out in the opening match and he actually, you know, on Wrestle Kingdom 14 Night One, he did the job in that opening match. So, I mean, again, that was just Liger through and through. Somebody who was there to make others shine. Somebody who was very much all about, he was a team player. He was somebody who was all about just making New Japan better and making others shine and not being, you know, it was not all about him. It was all about the show. It was not about him, even though to many fans it was. And that was the great irony, because Liger was such a star, had such a distinctive costume and was so famous globally. Had he put himself over in these matches and had he stuck around as champion for longer than he did, I don't think that many people would have resented him for it, because they liked him so much. And that, to me, just made him somebody that I admired even more, because he didn't do what he knew he could have done. And, you know, people would have accepted it and people would have applauded it even. So, but yeah, well, I mean, I was really quite moved by the retirement ceremony at New Year Dash and by the match, certainly on night one of Wrestle Kingdom. Somebody that, as long as I've been a fan, certainly before Superstars of Wrestling was ever created, he was somebody that I was a fan of and whose career I followed closely really throughout and to the end. So, yeah, just a tremendous performer. The fact that everyone knows who he is just tells you the sort of star that he was and still is to an extent. What are your memories of him, Kenny?
I don't really have too many memories of him. I've got to say, I was disappointed with the two multi-man matches on the way out. And everything that you've said is fair as to why that happened. I would like to have seen, even in an opener, him in a one-on-one match. I know maybe why they didn't do it, because he didn't feel he was up to that, or he felt he was past that. But like, even the stuff that he did 6 months ago with Minoru Suzuki, like, that was tremendous. I'd love to have seen something like that on this show. But I get why they didn't do it. I only really have two memories from him, and that's the Super Brawl match with Brian Pillman, because so many people had talked about it that it was one of the matches that I went and watched in the network a couple of years ago. That, along with Too Cold Scorpio and Chris Benoit on one of the WCW pay-per-views, I think from 93. I don't know what one that was. But anyway, that match. So those were two I'd always heard were great. And yeah, I always thought he was just a really cool character, and then seeing him against Tyler Breeze at TakeOver Brooklyn in 2015, he could still go. So yeah. I wish that I'd seen more of him in America, but you know, maybe I'll go back and seek out some more of his WCW stuff and check it out.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much material out there. You know, stuff with Sasuke was just amazing. You know, stuff with Benoit, it's obviously, you know, so weird watching Benoit matches, but it's I mean, the stuff with Benoit was just tremendous, and just so many great matches and so many title reigns throughout the 90s, and he was a huge part of that New Japan sort of revival during that era and modernization, and just the, you know, the flag bearer, the standard bearer of the junior heavyweight division and the booker of it as well. But Super J Cup is one event that you absolutely need to check out. And they did another one with in conjunction with War in December of 1995, I think it was. That was really good as well. But yeah, definitely check out the Super J Cup. There's some tremendous matches there.
Well, I do just want to ask you, we're not going to go through the full shows, but let me ask you about a couple of the big matches from each night of Wrestle Kingdom 40. First of all, what do you make of the two-night idea? This is the first year they've done it. Do you think that they should keep going two nights, or do you think that the one night was better for their biggest show of the year?
Well, I mean, I thought last year, when they announced that they were doing this, that it was overly ambitious, and I was proven wrong. So, I mean, I thought this time maybe the reason they did it over 2 days was it was on a Saturday and Sunday, so that was helpful. I mean, given, I think they drew over 70,000 paid over the two nights. I think it was just over 40,000 first night and just over 30,000 second night. I think those figures are...
That is correct, yep.
Yeah, I think those figures are accurate. And the fact they were able to draw that many people for two shows on consecutive nights, and these were long shows, and there was tremendous enthusiasm right up until the main events of both shows, just tells you that the gamble paid off. Yeah, I mean, I thought there's no way they're going to pull this off, and absolutely they did. So Yeah, I mean, it's up to them. I don't know whether... Have they announced whether they're going to do two shows next year?
They've not announced their plans for next year, so it seems like it's up in the air at the moment.
I know they've had to move the G1 because the Olympics is taking place over the summer, so I think the G1's going to be in October, I think it is. So they've had to move things around there. But yeah, I mean, the G1, obviously the G1 winner then challenges the IWGP Heavyweight Champion at Wrestle Kingdom. So because the G1's taking place later in the year, will the G1 winner, will it have the same gravitas for a show in January as it would have done for you know, a G1 winner that wins the tournament and wins the title shot in August? So, I mean, that there kind of affects things as well. But based on this performance at the box office and based on the response to these two shows, and people were really into them, they're very well reviewed, absolutely they could do it again. Absolutely they could.
Well, obviously the show's kind of kept the usual format of, you know, multi-man undercard matches and then top line kind of one-on-one matches. So on night one, we did see the IWGP Junior title on the line with Takahashi and Will Ospreay. Takahashi winning the title. What did you make of this? I know before that Will Ospreay's not been your favourite, but how do you think he's doing now in New Japan overall?
Well, I mean, he's obviously a huge star there. People are so into his matches. This is the fella Hiromu, who I probably pronounced that incorrectly, who suffered the devastating neck injury in summer of 18.
Unbelievable to watch this match with him. After, if you didn't know, but if you watch it again, you knew. Like, how did this guy come back and be able to be doing all this stuff again? It's unreal.
I don't know. I mean, he was out over a year, I think it was, Takahashi. And he came back, looks as good as ever, doing all sorts of crazy moves. Doesn't seem to have any physical limitations at all. I mean, the moves they were doing were just outrageous, weren't they? I mean, and the precision as well and the execution is just extraordinary, really, to watch. I mean, I don't really like these type of matches, but I mean, to the audience that it's geared towards, this was a out-of-this-world tour de force classic performance, and the heat down the stretch for those final near falls was just, I think, second only to Okada versus Ibushi in the main event. So, I mean, this was, to me, this was far better than Jay White versus Naito. I mean, I thought that match dragged. I'm not a huge fan of Jay White at all. I don't think he's up to the job. They've pushed him into this spot. Partly it's the booking, the overload his match is with a lot of American heel stuff. I think he's a good performer, but I don't think he's at this level. And I thought that was proven here in this match with Naito, which went, I think, nearly 34 minutes, just lasted too long. But to me, the two matches that were viewed as the two biggest matches of the night were Takahashi versus Will Ospreay, which had the happy ending as well, with Takahashi pinning Ospreay to capture the IWGP Junior Heavyweight title. So, I mean, that was such a popular outcome there. That was probably the number two match of the night for the audience, behind only Okada versus Ibushi, which was pretty damn exceptional, I've got to say, the main event. Did you watch the main event, Kenny?
I did. I watched the top matches. I'm here with you. Like, I didn't see Naito and Jay White, but the fact that I didn't, you know, because I just watched Liger's 8-man, Moxley and Archer, Takahashi and Ospreay and Okada and Ibushi from night one. And nobody, because I remember asking a few people, I said, if I have to watch four matches, what would they be? And nobody suggested watch Naito and Jay White. Like, not one person. I didn't even know that match had happened until watching the stuff from night two and realizing Naito had beaten Jay White on night one, and that was the whole, you know, unification thing. But I think that says a lot about why, you know, maybe Jay White not clicking with people. That nobody's really talking about that match. But
They were given the chance, they were given the time, it was went on second to last. So, I mean, if he was going to deliver, then this was the time to do it. I mean, Naito's, as we know now, he's double champ. So, I mean, he's the man there now. So if you can't have a blowaway match with that guy, who are you going to have a blowaway match with? So,
I liked Takahashi and Ospreay. Okada and Ibushi for me, although it was very good, was just too long for me. Like 40 minutes of sort of pure wrestling is not, it's just, it's never going to be for me. But I thought the match was good. You know, I could have easily shaved 10 minutes off it and been happier. But Ibushi just seems to want to kill himself at all costs.
Yeah, there was some of the moves are just like, you think, how the hell did the guy get up from that? Just amazing, really. And amazing in a way that's sort of impressive, but at the same time terrifying. And you just don't want to see it happen again. Absolutely, you don't.
I mean, the thing is, like, I mean, obviously, I don't watch it all the time, so this is, I'm maybe not the person to say it, but the thing about Okada that's pretty impressive is that Okada seems to be someone who's in some ways like New Japan's Roman Reigns, in terms of like the guy who's featured so heavily all the time, not in terms of they had him win a battle royal when he shouldn't have and have debuted him, but like, the thing about Okada is, even though he's been around for, he's been main event in the Tokyo Dome for the last, what, 3 years, 4 years? He's been main event in, anytime I've really seen it, he's on top.
Yeah, I mean, they made him IWGP champion for the first time in 2012, so he's coming up 8 years.
Yeah, so he's been on top for years and years and years, but the fans still seem to enjoy him in that spot, and he seems to still deliver in that spot time after time after time, and I think that's an impressive stat that he is still on top, having these top matches that are so well received every single year.
Well, I mean, it absolutely is. I mean, he's continuing to do this in these really long matches that people still respond to, and like, I mean, as you say, it was nearly 40 minutes, wasn't it? Okada versus Ibushi. And the fans towards the end were absolutely into it. I mean, I know you didn't. It's not few matches that last that long, and I was kind of in agreement. The match didn't really need to be that long, but it was still very impressive that fans were so into it at the end. I mean, we've seen in WWE and other American promotions over the years where you'll have a match that lasts too long, and towards the end, people have just had enough, and they just want it to end. And that was absolutely not the case here. This match peaked in the final moments. So that just tells you how impressive these guys are. Absolutely tremendous. What did you think of Moxley versus Lance Archer, Kenny?
With Lance Archer, I feel like he's always been in kind of tag team stuff. So I've not really... But he's a beast. Like, he really is a beast. And Moxley, again, just seems to be more motivated in this kind of character than he ever did seem as Dean Ambrose. So he just seems more at home. I was surprised to see him win the IWGP US title, because I just kind of didn't think that was going to be on the cards. But, you know, it did. And he went on tonight to face Juice Robinson. But I liked Archer and Moxley. I like the kind of fight element of it. What did you think?
Yeah, I enjoyed the finish. I thought the spot where Archer removed a small plastic bag from his pocket and put it over Moxley's face, and then Moxley somehow couldn't remove it from his face as Archer held it over his mouth, was one of the fakest things I've seen in the last year. And you're like, what's this? How the hell did this get? How did this pass?
He's went from getting back dropped onto barbed wire to blown into a bag.
Yeah, a tiny little piece of plastic, and somehow, you know, even though it's not like he was handcuffed or something like that, somehow he wasn't able to remove it from his face. And then he was right as rain just a few moments later. That was a hell of a finish, wasn't it, with the DDT, isn't it, off the ring apron onto the two tables on the side?
Yeah, the paradigm shift thing.
Did they call it the Death Rider over there? Is it the Death Rider or is it? No, that's his Power Driver, sorry. So, yeah, I mean, that was a hell of a finish there. I mean, that did look devastating, got a huge pop. I think Lance Archer cut all his arm up. I mean, there's some sloppiness in the match. It was Texas Death Match, so there's all these add-ons and gimmicks, which in many ways is an easier match to work.
But it didn't go to kind of like lights out Kenny Omega territory. So like it didn't, you know, like that match kind of lost me the lights out match, whereas I was still with the Archer and Moxley match. So it worked better for me. I don't know why, but yeah, it did.
It was shorter, wasn't it, Kenny? And they didn't do as much. and they just...
They picked their spots better, it felt like.
Yeah. They didn't hang around. They just, you know, let's get to the finish. Let's get this over with. And we've still got three big matches to go after this, all of which are really long. So, yeah, they didn't outstay the welcome. I think that's the reason why it worked with this audience. And also, it was, you know, it was different to everything else on the show. Should mention as well, actually, Juice Robinson and Dave Finlay, they captured the IWGP Tag Team title. Thought that was a really good match. Came alive at the end. So, you know, Juice Robinson is somebody who's obviously reinvented himself out there. Dave Finlay is somebody who's... who you think he could get a job with WWE fairly easily, but he's been over in New Japan for years. And I think he's really doing the right thing, getting as much experience as he can over there. You know, I'm not sure if he's somebody that would really excel in the WWE system, but he's doing well for himself out there. Fans weren't that into it at the beginning, but towards the end really came alive. And that was a really good match as well.
Well, let's move on to night two. The big matches from night two that we can talk about is before we talk about Tanahashi and Jericho, actually, we'll kind of tie this into the conversation. The news came out since last week that Access TV and Anthem basically told New Japan, you know, we want you to have a relationship with us. They said no, so they were then kicked off TV. So there's now no renewal of the contract. And it seems that AEW and New Japan might be working together, given that Jericho had his title here, and the stipulation that was approved by Tony Khan and was on New Japan's website was that if Tanahashi won, he would receive a match for the AEW Championship. What do you make of that story? And, you know, I know I asked you before, do you think it makes sense for New Japan and AEW to work together? But, I mean, now that... I mean, do you think that for Impact, they kind of just had to make that move as well? They had to kind of say, look, you know, if you're on our channel, we want you with us. Or do you think they should play a longer game with it?
I think they should have played a longer game. I think we talked about this last week, didn't we? I mean, New Japan is not going to work with Impact Wrestling in its current condition. It's just not going to. And as much as I like Impact Wrestling, it's hard for me to believe it's really going to grow much further than where it is right now. If it does, it's going to take time. So New Japan, to me, would be, you know, it's beneath New Japan to work with Impact Wrestling right now. So I think that was, I mean, I understand why Impact did it, but to me, it's like, well, you know, maybe you need to prove to them that you're worthy, you know, you're worthy of doing business with New Japan on some level rather than just giving them this ultimatum. And then when they don't cave to it, you boom off the channel. So I don't think it was a smart move, really. I mean, I don't know whether it really would have made much difference either way, but
it
at
just
least...
It feels like the way, you know, because Impact have been trying to have a relationship with New Japan for years, right? They've been trying to fix that. All. Now, why, for people who don't know, because I think it is worth bringing up, what is it that TNA in its form previously did to New Japan that annoyed them so much that over a decade later, they just have no interest in working with any version of that company? What did they do?
Well, I think it was the Okada business, wasn't it? I think that was one of the reasons.
Because they had Okada be like, what was the gimmick again that he did?
They had him, didn't they have him as like, was it Okata? I think they billed him as that, and they had him in, was it the character that Bruce Lee played in The Green Hornet? Was he based on that? I believe
it was meant to be that, yeah. But
I think it was. But it was just so demeaning. It was so degrading to Okada. They didn't even... I mean, I remember at the time I would have a photographer at most Impact tapings, and he would be on Explosion. He would be doing matches on Explosion. And he wasn't given any respect at all by TNA's Rook Impact. I believe Scott Demure and Don Callis have since apologised for that, and this was during the Dixie Carter era. So in many ways, the current... brain trust at Impact Wrestling, they were not they weren't responsible for that. It was a different management structure entirely who was responsible for the all Okada business. But I mean, Tanahashi was there as well for a while. They didn't really do much with him. I mean, they had dealings with they brought in other New Japan talent, and I don't think they were ever really, I don't think New Japan ever really felt like it was a priority to TNA. And, you know, this would have been during Hogan, Bischoff era, Vince Russo was still there up until 2012, of course. So, I mean, I think you could, you know, you could kind of pin it on those people who were running it, who were never really going to see the value of New Japan in an American company on a week-to-week basis, maybe for a one-off pay-per-view. But also, you know, we're going back sort of 2011-2012 here. It was 2012 when Okada had his, you know, he was reintroduced to the Japanese audience at the, I think it was the Dome show that year, January 4th. And then he beat, shockingly beat Tanahashi the next month to win the IWGP Heavyweight title. And then he had this unbelievable year where he grew into the role against everyone's predictions. No one saw that coming. So, but if you go back to where New Japan was in 2011, 2012 in America, it was not the force that it is today. So things have changed totally for New Japan on the world stage. So, I mean, I think TNA had a different attitude towards New Japan. New Japan didn't have the international presence, didn't have the international respect and the international audience that it now has. So I think there's a lot of things that went on, and I think there's just a lot of, there's obviously bad blood there. There's resentment there that more wasn't done with the talent, you know, when TNA was in a more prominent position in the States than New Japan was. I mean, I don't know whether New Japan's bigger in the States right now than Impact is. I don't know. I mean, possibly it is, because it can certainly sell more tickets to live events than Impact Wrestling can. But that's a debatable point as to which one is the biggest force in America right now. Probably New Japan, I would have said, certainly as a ticket seller. So
all I was going to say was that I feel like Anthem and Access TV, with all that bad blood that you've just mentioned, would have said, look, for the next 12 months, you know, we just want to show you what kind of company we are. And then at the end of the 12 months, if you want to work together, great. If you don't, we'll go our separate ways. Like, yes. Give them a year.
Yeah.
Because then it's like you're not putting them against a wall and saying, you have no choice.
Yeah.
So, I mean, again, it seems like a crazy decision. But
I mean, New Japan's not going to be pushed around by Impact Wrestling. It's just not. Why would it be? It doesn't need to be. You know, it reflects badly on it in terms of its image. You know, why would it want to do business with this company that really besmirched some of its talent and was really quite disrespectful to it as a company? Especially now, New Japan doesn't really need Impact, and I'm sure New Japan's setting its sights much higher in the West and wants to be doing business with a promotion that can enhance its appearance and image to a much wider audience. So, I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. Impact Wrestling was rash to do this. I do not know. I can't understand. As a business decision, this makes no sense at all to me. I'm not sure if New Japan and Impact would have ever happened. But had, you know, they attempted to atone and rebuild bridges, then maybe something could have done down the line. But now it's just not going to happen. And if New Japan's going to do business with anyone, one assumes it's going to be AEW.
What did you make of Jericho's match with Tanahashi that they had? Jericho got the win with a kind of lion tamer version of the Walls of Jericho, where he kind of really cinched it in, as opposed to the usual kind of Boston Crab that he does. So Tanahashi's not getting a shot at the AEW World title. How do you think? This is Jericho's third year in the Tokyo Dome for Wrestle Kingdom.
Yeah, I thought I enjoyed the match. I wasn't expecting to. I was thinking, is this? I saw the pictures of Jericho. It looked like he's been having a little bit too much of the bubbly, hasn't he, Kenny? Let's be honest.
I'm saying nothing.
I was thinking, but yeah, it was very well done. I mean, there was a lot of little gimmicks there. There was a lot of distractions, a lot of diversions. As we know, Jericho's 49 now. But I mean, Tanahashi is really one of the smartest workers in the world. He knows how to do story matches. I mean, there's a real basic story there with Jericho going back to the Boston Crab, to the Lion Tamer, Walls of Jericho. What's he? Is he calling it the Walls of Jericho now? Walls of Jericho.
It is the Walls of Jericho, yeah.
Walls of Jericho. Lion Tamer, Boston Crab, whatever you want to call it.
The only reason I said Lion Tamer is because when he called it the Lion Tamer, that was when he used to actually really cinch it the way he did there to Tanahashi.
That's right.
But when it went to Walls of Jericho, he got quite lazy with it.
yeah, real high angle one at the end, wasn't it? That, which he secured the submission from Tanahashi, which was a shocking result. I mean, I thought for sure that Tanahashi was going to score the win. You know, full credit to New Japan and Tanahashi for booking this outcome, putting Jericho over via submission in such a convincing fashion. But I thought the match was very well done. I thought Jericho had a really good night. The audience was so into it. I just thought it was a really smart, really clever match, just put together by total pros. I would urge everyone to watch this match. I think it was really well done. What did you think, Kenny?
This was my favourite match of the two nights, to be honest. It was more my style of match. I think Jericho's just really found his niche again in this character. And, you know, like, what he's able to do in the ring in these kind of matches when he's, like, what, 48, 49 years old?
49.
It's really impressive. You know, this was not the Chris Jericho greatest hits show that he was putting on here. And he was coming in to prove a point that he could hang in this kind of environment. And he had a different style of match to everybody else. And I liked the idea that through the match they were working on the kind of... I'm just going to call it the Boston Crab version. He was working on the Boston Crab. You know, he's hitting Tanahashi with a code breaker when Tanahashi comes off the top. Tanahashi hits him with a code breaker. They were on the outside. I just thought they did a really clever wrestling match. And the other thing is, it was 22 and a half minutes. It was perfect. It was a good time. Got you building up to it. The near falls were really good, but they weren't doing 105 things at one time. I just thought it was so well wrestled, and he really, you know, the comparison, some people say that he's like Hollywood Hogan in 98, and I'm like, show me one match in 98 where Hogan even did 10% of this.
That person should be made to watch every Hollywood Hogan match from 1998 as a punishment, bloody hell. Yeah, it was just very well paced, expertly paced. They didn't rush anything. It was just all done. Everything was done when it needed to be done. And they saved a really big moves for the ending. And I didn't know the outcome before I watched it. I ended up watching it. I think I ended up watching it this morning, but hadn't looked up the outcome before I watched the match. And I was surprised. I thought Tanahashi was going over for sure. And he didn't do. And I was just like, wow, what a tremendous outcome from New Japan and Tanahashi. And you know what,
even in contrast to the Impact stuff, it's like, even though there's all this bad blood with New Japan and AEW, New Japan are making sure that, you know, the AEW world champion guy goes over, and that also mends some fences because it looks good. But you know, it's also a good political move.
Yeah, what an olive branch. I mean, you know, this was New Japan saying to AEW, this is what we're prepared to do for you without any official agreement in place. You know, we want to do business. To me, that was the wrestling, the booking equivalent of that. And I'm sure everyone in AEW read that message loud and clear. And I'm confident it's going to result in some business relationship of some type between the two companies this year.
So the main event of night two was obviously leading to who was going to be the double champ. It was Okada with the IWGP title and Naito with the Intercontinental title. They have the big main event, and Naito wins in 35 minutes over Okada. Where did this match rate for you on matches across the whole two nights, and was it a worthy one to close it?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was good. I didn't think it was as good as Okada versus Ibushi. Didn't enjoy it as much as Jericho versus Tanahashi. Felt maybe it went on maybe just a little bit too long. But I mean, it was a different match to the one that Okada had the night before. And like, you know, the guy wrestled, what was that, over 70 minutes, you know, over two nights. And the audience was into it. And you're just like, wow, this just illustrates the level of talent, conveys the brilliance of this man, that he can have matches of this caliber on consecutive nights over this time period before what was essentially the same audience, a slightly smaller crowd the second night. But I'm sure many of the people who went to night one were there for night two. And people were really into this as well. Great to see Naito score the win. I mean, he'd been there before back in 2016, I think he was. Wasn't given a particularly long heavyweight title reign then. I think it was Okada who ended his reign. I think it only lasted about 70 days, just over 2 months. So, I mean, one assumes that this will be Naito's proper reign, his chance to really represent the company as champion over a period of, you know, you would have thought at least 6 months. So, the you know, the emphasis is definitely on him right now. The onus is on him as well to prove that he's up to the challenge. Because let's face it, Kenny, Okada is a bloody difficult act to follow. So, you know, let's see what he's got. But yeah, double champion, first time. I think that's the first time there's ever been a double, the first time anyone has held the IWGP heavyweight and intercontinental title simultaneously. I think it is a first. I'm sure they did say.
I think, yeah, that was the big sell, right? That's the big sell of who's going to be the first double champs. Now it's Naito two belts. But then, of course, his parade was rained on by Kenta, who made his presence known that he's going to be coming after Naito. And, I mean, what, 12 months ago, when Hideo Itami was still in WWE, I couldn't have imagined, you know, because I think his last match on WWE TV was the January 8th, 2019 episode 205 Live, where
Was he in the four-way Royal Rumble?
That was his last match. He had a match in 205 Live where he won against Cedric Alexander to get into the four-way, and then he was in the four-way at Royal Rumble. So when you saw him on the kickoff show of the Royal Rumble, losing to Buddy Murphy, Kalisto, and fucking Tozawa, I would never have imagined.
Did we really need an F word there, Kenny?
We did. Well, fucking pre-show kickoff bullshit. If you told me a year ago, at that time, whoever wins on the final night, final match at Wrestle Kingdom, going to be attacked by Hideo Itami. I'd go, okay, what are you smoking? But it came true.
It happened. Yeah.
Which, I mean, is a real bad indictment on WWE more than anything, sadly. The level of talent that's there that could be doing so much more is on so many different levels kind of not getting to reach their potential. So I'm happy for Kenta, and I hope he nails it in the feud with Naito, and it's just good to see nice things come for a guy who I think deserved more.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree. I mean, he had a lot of injury problems in NXT and WWE, and, you know, Japanese wrestlers in general, I mean, the record in WWE is not brilliant. I mean, it's been a struggle for so many of them to make it there. And I always thought Itami, it was going to be tricky for him to make it, certainly on the main roster, you know, knowing what the expectations and, you know, what they want from wrestlers. That was always going to be a difficult one. It was always going to be tough for him to really break through and make fans out of the decision makers in the corridors of power of WWE. So I wasn't surprised that he didn't make it there. And absolutely, he's back where he needs to be. New Japan's put his faith in him. It's given him he did really well last year when he returned. And here he is. Yeah, he's going to be the first challenger to Naito, presumably, for both titles. So huge spot for him. I mean, it's, as you say, it's really good to see somebody who failed so utterly in WWE, really redeem himself in an environment that's tailor-made for him. And you know, that's just the way it is. You know, you go back and look at, you know, Ozawa and Kobashi when they were in the prime. If they'd gone to WWF, as it would have been then, I mean, it just wouldn't have worked. And some people just don't work in other systems, and that's just the way it is. And, you know, you've got to find the environment which, you know, which complements you, and Kenta has absolutely done that.
So let's move on to WWE. Last Friday on SmackDown, We've not covered SmackDown, have we? I'm not having a stroke.
We have not. We have not.
On SmackDown, the big three talking points were the returns. We saw Sheamus returning to beat up Chad Gable. We saw John Morrison align himself with The Miz backstage after The Miz turned heel on Kofi Kingston. And we also saw The Usos making their return as they assisted Roman Reigns when he was getting beat up by King Corbin and the Lackeys. What did you make of the show, the heel turn by The Miz and the big returns?
Well, it was more interesting than the last few weeks. I mean, not that that was difficult because so little had happened on the previous episodes as we've discussed in some detail. Actually, not in detail.
We actually just haven't discussed the show for the last 2 weeks because it was so nondescript.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, wasn't the silence so loud, Kenny? So we had The Miz at the start. He's wandering around backstage looking mean, trying to look serious. I mean, it's just an epic fail whenever Miz tries to look tough. So he's urging Daniel Bryan to beat The Fiend. You know, he's done this to me. I'm still mad about it. So he's backstage and he's talking to Kofi and Big E, knocks the pancakes on the ground. That's fighting talk, Kenny. I mean, if somebody knocked your iron brew out your hand, how would you react?
I'd stab them in the face.
Well, now I'll be warned.
You're in Glasgow. You got to up your game.
So, you know, he knocks the pancakes to the floor. Big E's mad. So then we have the match between, as you say, between Kofi Kingston and The Miz. Kingston scores like a fluke pin on The Miz, who then suddenly turns heel on Kingston. And I just thought, where's this come from? This should have been week four. This should have taken place on the first SmackDown in February, not the first SmackDown in January, Kenny. I mean, talk about a rush storyline. I mean, I just thought this was pathetic, quite frankly. I just really did. So he attacks Kingston. Big E jumps in to make the save. Miz treats up the ramp. He's yelling at the audience who's booing him. How dare you after everything I've been through? I mean, really, what's he been through? I mean, this should have been a slow, progressive thing. And the storytelling here, Kenny, was abysmal. What did you think of it?
I mean, it was okay. But it's not exactly filling me with high hopes. SmackDown just seems like no matter what they do, it's almost a bit bland right now.
Yeah, I mean, this could have been a really good... I mean, I don't know how good a story it would have been. Because, I mean, Miz, obviously they needed to make some changes to him after the fiasco at TLC. I mean, he's just been a waste of space ever since.
The one thing you've got to say, though, is anytime The Miz is a heel and he's working with other people, he tends to make the other people... You know, he's done it with Alex Riley, he did it with Damian Sandow, he did it with Bo Dallas and Curtis Axel. So, you know, maybe Morrison being with him is going to be a good thing, and maybe Morrison and The Miz against New Day, even though it was, you know, completely rushed. And it was. But then, you know, the thing was, The Miz's babyface run was kind of dead after he never really got to beat Shane McMahon.
Well, yeah, I mean, he just had a terrible 2019, just abysmal. And, yeah, there was that, obviously, the match we talked about at TLC with The Fiend and his whole behaviour after that. But to me, you had a story here, and this played into the other stories of everyone who faces Bray Wyatt or The Fiend. It changes them. But, I mean, let's just have this over a period of weeks here where The Miz changes. We didn't need to rush John Morrison's return. That could have waited a few more weeks. Just feels like they just couldn't be bothered. I mean, Miz is backstage. Kathy Kelly tries to get a word with him. And instead, a mahogany-coloured John Morrison opened the door and said that Miz had no further comment. I mean, what a tan on John Morrison.
Listen, when you're in your 40s, you want to make sure that you've got your tan on. The thing is, the guy looks like 31. So, you know, the reason I don't use fake tan, Finn, is mainly because I don't want to come across like I'm really obviously trying, and it came across like he was very obviously trying to look particularly tanned.
Kenny, we all know that you don't have to try. You just make it look so effortless.
Oh, thanks, Finn. It's my youthful complexion. I take it after you.
Thank you. But yeah, John Morrison's back. He's using that name. He's still got an amazing head of hair. You know, one... you know, assumes that he'd be coming out in those big coats that he used to wear back in 2011. I mean, this is probably not a bad spot for The Miz to be with Morrison, and maybe they can be an effective team. And I think, you know, 4 weeks from now, I won't even care about everything that I've just said. All I'm saying is that there was a really good story here and they just rushed it.
They did indeed.
Yeah, I mean, elsewhere on the show, I mean, I'd like to point out that Elias has improved on the guitar. Just want to put that out there, Kenny.
Not on the microphone, not as a character, but on guitar.
On guitar, yeah. We had Shorty G backstage. You know, he was insulted by the revival. Shorty G unleashed his new motto, which is rise over size. Do you have any mottos, Kenny?
Don't talk pish is my motto, which ties directly into a retort for Shorty G. The thing is, like, sometimes I wonder, like, when you get people who are, like, writing babyface promos, like, they're writing Shorty G's or they're writing Ricochets, and you're going, like, who on earth? Like, it must be the, like, they must think that they're writing for, like, child audiences. Because this verbiage is just like, nobody wants to have a beer with that. Like, would you want to have a beer with somebody who goes, do you know, Kenny, everyone can be a superhero? Fuck off! Do you know what I mean? Nobody wants to be around that guy.
So then we had the short jokes, ha ha ha, straight out of CBeebies, although I'm probably not, because, you know, you're not allowed to pick on kids for being shorter than you, so that's probably wrong. I'm not allowed to watch that. So we had Shorty G versus Dash Wilder match. Shorty G made Wilder tap out. Scott Dawson jumps in, starts pasting short stuff, and then, as you said, Sheamus returned. He drives Revival out of the ring. Is he going to be a babyface? Well, apparently not, because then he wallops Shorty with the bro kick. So the fella is back. And what was the other big story? It was the return of the Usos. That's right, yeah. So we had Roman Reigns and Daniel Bryan versus King Corbin and Dolph Ziggler. Fiend turned up at ringside. The match kind of just sort of ends. Then Corbin and Ziggler, they'd handcuffed Reigns to the bottom rope, and they were going to give him another dog food bath. And then Jimmy and Jay run out and flatten Dolph and Corbin with super kicks. So, yeah, they've been forgiven. They've returned. This is the first time we've seen them since before SummerSlam, I think it is.
Yeah, so they're back. Lots of returns. But last night on Raw, we had a ton of stuff happen. The big news story coming out of it is that Paul Heyman has told us that Brock Lesnar will be in the Men's Royal Rumble match, and it means that anybody from Raw, SmackDown, NXT that wants to get their hands on him can get their hands on him, because he'll be getting in as number one. We assume to set up whatever his WrestleMania match is going to be. They've not said the title is on the line. I expected it to, but everybody else online appears to think that it's not going to be on the line. What do you make of this development? Is it interesting? Is it something that's going to get people talking? And any predictions for who Lesnar ends up having a program with coming out of it?
I mean, when I first read about it, the report I read stated that Lesnar was defending his title in the Royal Rumble match. And I thought, how is he going to do that? And you're right, that was not mentioned once during Paul Heyman's promo. And since he's the one who's running the damn show, if the title was going to be on the line, I think Heyman would have mentioned it. So to me, it wouldn't make sense at all for Lesnar to defend the title in this match. I can't see.
So what happens if he wins then? If he wins, does he then get a title shot against somebody else?
Well, we know he's not going to win. I mean, you know, Heyman was saying that he's going to be his first man in. Quite how he can make these decisions. You know, how can Lesnar just leave SmackDown for Raw? And then how can he just suddenly decide that he's going to be number one in the Raw Rumble? I'm not quite sure how he has all this pull.
He's got friends in high places.
Friends in high places, that's it. So, but you're right, yeah. If he does win, what happens then? I guess the second to last person, penultimate person to be eliminated would get the title shot. I'm not sure. I don't think he's going to win. But you imagine, don't you, that Lesnar's WrestleMania opponent will be unveiled in this match. I'm not sure who it's going to be. I think the fact that Lesnar's in this match sort of is really, in a sense, a disappointment, because it just proves that WWE either hasn't tried or doesn't have anyone ready to wrestle Lesnar in a big match on the Royal Rumble undercard. It's like they don't really have anyone who could conceivably face him, so they've had to put him in the Royal Rumble match. I think that's really the story here. I mean, as long as it's not Tyson Fury, Kenny, I don't really care who he is.
Hard same, hard same.
I mean, maybe it would. I think it's probably going to be Drew McIntyre, just based upon the way things have been laid out over the last few weeks. I think maybe it'll be Drew versus Lesnar. There'll be a square off. There'll be a big brawl. Maybe they'll eliminate each other, brawl up to the back, and maybe that will... No, that can't be right, because McIntyre has to win, doesn't he? But maybe he could eliminate Lesnar and then win and then get the shot. So I think that's what I'd like to see. It does feel like they're in the process of turning McIntyre babyface, and it doesn't really feel like there's anyone else who's sort of ready now or is likely to be ready in 3 months to wrestle Brock Lesnar. Can you think of anyone else, Kenny?
I mean, I think that I still hope it's that Drew McIntyre, because, you know, he on Raw, he seemingly now is a babyface, so that could make sense. I think McIntyre would be a good one against Lesnar. I think he would probably be my favourite pick. Because you got to imagine that Owens and Rollins is probably going to get dragged out to WrestleMania.
Yeah.
I don't think Aleister Black is anywhere near ready.
Forget it.
I know people are saying Matt Riddle, but I don't think Matt Riddle is over enough to a big audience to be that guy. I don't think he's done enough yet in WWE. Like I would have him be NXT champion first and stuff. Keith Lee's maybe a dark horse pick that you could go for, but or maybe Finn Balor finally comes to revenge after last year, comes at him as the demon. I mean, that's not going to happen. I'm just saying names. But yeah, it's interesting to have him in the Rumble. I guess we'll see where it goes. But we had also on Raw, we did have the reappearance of the pastor, Lana and Lashley's pastor, who got tackled by security because they didn't know that he was part of the show. What a poor guy. Imagine if you're an actor and you're going to do a wee speech and you get rugby tackled by two security.
It was unbelievable, wasn't it? We had the AJ Styles versus Akira Tozawa match. Styles won easily with the RKO. He's leaving. There's a camera on the ring. And then this guy enters the ring, and then suddenly two people like rugby tackle him to the ground, and it's not acknowledged on commentary. Are you thinking, what's this happened on a WWE show?
Absolute madness.
Communication breakdown somewhere there.
But yeah, so anyway, then we get this really weird thing where we get like Rusev's on a green screen with a beach behind him being like, I'm going on vacation instead, but he's just at a green screen. And then it all transpires that Rusev's going to face Lashley next week, Lana's in the corner, and then Liv Morgan later does an interview where she says that she's going to be in Rusev's corner. So, I mean, if you were tuning in for the fallout, I feel that some people may have been disappointed I don't know what the word is, the follow-up.
It just felt like so anticlimactic, didn't it?
Like, why does Liv Morgan want to be in Rusev's corner if she loves Lana? Why is Lashley wanting to tell Lana to shut up, apart from obvious reasons? And then why is Rusev a green screen pretending he's on a honeymoon? And why would he be on a honeymoon when he didn't get married?
I mean, the whole dialogue here is just, well, exactly. I mean, because at the start of this ceremony, Lashley and Lana then got married, didn't they? The minister had these special powers, you know, these superpowers, where he could just marry them. He could just marry them like that. So it's just over with. So she's got the ring. Lana's complaining about the pathetic civilians in the audience. Lashley's calling Rusev a loser. As you say, Rusev appears on the big screen with an obvious green screen in the background with this beach and this palm tree. And I mean, the only thing he said of any interest was that Lashley should probably cautioned against Lashley opening a joint bank account with Lana because Lana had cleared their bank account out. I mean, there was a lot of opportunity, a lot of scope here for some comedy, and there really wasn't any. And then they moved into this sort of transitioned into this sort of serious finale where Rusev's saying, I'm going to be the Bulgarian brute. And Lashley out of the blue tells Lana to shut up when she's ranting. And Lana did react to that, but not really in a way that you expected. So I figure that there's some dissension there. And maybe it'll all be over between Lana and Lashley after next week's match. But it seems to me like they're heading for Splitsville already and they've only just got married. But at the end here, yeah, Rusev and Lashley were really trying to lay on how serious this was and that there was that they both wanted revenge and they both wanted this match. And I think didn't Lashley say that he was going to like rip Rusev's balls off or something like that? Or I've got it the other way around there, Kenny.
You do. I mean, what you're really trying to say is it was shite. It's really what you're skirting around it, but that's what I think you're saying.
It just went all over the emotional map, didn't it?
You know, which, no, it did not.
Which is, you know, a euphemism for it was a complete muddled mess.
All over the emotional map. I'm going to use that. We also had in the show a really cracking match with Rey Mysterio and Andrade, which at the end just had this absolutely... I don't even know what to say because it was... Rey Mysterio does a move on the outside to Andrade that then hits Zelina Vega. Jerry Lawler calls her Melina when she's on
Melina.
The ground.
I noticed that.
Because of course he does. And so Rey Mysterio for a moment sort of feigns like, oh God, what did I do? I didn't mean to hit her. Then Andrade puts him back in the ring, goes to put his finisher on him. The referee stops this, like shoves Mysterio off of Andrade, separates them, then goes over to Rey Mysterio and very loudly says, go back to her. Keeps Andrade back, makes Rey go out again to try and, you know, when obviously she's you know, pretending.
Selling the blow with Mysterio landing on top of her, Rey's more remorseful.
And then Mysterio ends up in the ring pinned anyway. But the whole thing is like, if somehow they missed a spot, how is a referee allowed to pull somebody off of a finishing move and then like shout at somebody to go back to do their place?
It was very strange, wasn't it, to watch this unfold? And it's like, you know, it seems unusual to me that Rey Mysterio would have blown it. Because, I mean, he's there at ringside looking remorseful. I mean, it's not his fault that he's crashed into Zelina, but he's a babyface. You know, he's landed on a woman and it's terrible and he feels bad about it. I think he'd really conveyed that message to us, the viewers, by this point. I don't think he needed to go back to ringside and lay it on any thicker because we knew that. But yeah, it was a bit weird. So he goes back in the ring and then the referee, you know, Andrade's there going to finish off Rey and then the referee's separating them. He must have been getting messages from the back. I mean, the referee's not going to go into business for himself here. I mean, he's just not going to. So the referee must have been receiving instructions from the back that we need, this needs to happen. But it was kind of clumsy the way that it was executed.
All over the emotional map.
Very good, Kenny. I must use that. But it was just strange. And I don't know why. I have no idea why they didn't handle this more smoothly. And there's a lot of ways that they could have done it without the referee sort of obviously separating them like that. And then, as you said, relaying instructions to Mysterio audibly so we could hear them. And he's got to go back to ringside to lay on even thicker this emotion that we've already seen from him, only for him then to return to the ring and lose to Andrade's finisher. I mean, what a mess. It really was. I think a lot of people watching it probably would have just maybe kind of thought, is this real? Was that supposed to happen? And I think a lot of viewers actually would have thought to themselves, oh, that wasn't supposed to happen. Ray's really upset. And I think many people watching would have thought that it actually added to the realism, like as if something really had gone wrong in this match. I mean, we know it had to an extent because of the way the referee reacted, but it just sort of seemed like they'd gone off script here. So I think for a lot of viewers at home, I don't think they'll have really thought less of what happened than we do, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the referee pulling him off the finish was just like, the match is dead at that point. Like, no matter what you do, that's just like, you're literally going up and having the referee go, nope, you've done the wrong thing, go back from this part of the script. It's death to a match, which is a shame because they had a really good match, and then that finish, to me, just took my complete buzz away from what I've been watching.
Yeah, and then afterwards, Andrade ripped Rey's mask off, and then backstage, Rey attacked Andrade, got the mask back. So it looks like the feud's continuing. I'm sure nothing like this is going to happen again in a match between these two. I mean, I was trying to work out afterwards if I'd seen anything like this before in a match. And I surely must have seen something like this before when someone suffered an injury. There was obviously the very famous Candice Michelle, I think it was Beth Phoenix, wasn't it? We've talked about this before, where Candice was knocked out. I think we talked about this one before.
Yeah, we did talk about it.
I mean, this is going back well over 10 years now, I think it was late 2000s. It was late 2000s. And that was a really strange one as well. But that was due to an injury, whereas this wasn't due to an injury, which in a sense makes it even stranger. I mean, you can understand why people react, overreact or don't react in the way they should when someone suffers an injury because they're in shock. But in a situation like this, it was even odder that this happened. So what else was there on Raw, Kenny, that you liked or disliked?
I enjoyed Drew McIntyre beating up No Way Jose and him, you know, just basically like the moment where he hit him with the second Claymore kick, and then he like flipped around and he was like, didn't even drop the microphone. I was like, that's great. That's a Scotsman for you. And I'm ready to see him do more. And the fans got behind him in the end, so I think that was a success.
Yeah, I thought that was well done. I thought Street Profits versus Viking Raiders versus Gallows and Anderson, I thought that was a bit of a flop, really. I thought Street Profits had done well in previous weeks, and they did have mic work before this match, which I think is a sign that WWE as faith has been restored in them and that they see them as stars of the future. And certainly it was Carl Anderson who did the job here. So the Street Profits were protected on the finish. But I thought the match should have been better. What did you think of the match?
Yeah. I mean, the problem is the Viking Raiders, I hate. They bore me to tears. The club just feel like nothing. So the Street Profits were the only kind of interesting team in the match, and I mean, I'm glad the highest praise I can give it is I'm glad they weren't pinned.
But, yeah.
Like, look at the crowd at the end. You've got like three people going war, war, war because they just they feel like they should, but there's no there's nothing dynamic about the War Raiders. There's nothing exciting about them or the Viking Raiders, whatever they're called. And I just kind of want to change the channel whenever they're on, even though they're good wrestlers, but I don't like their aesthetic. I don't like their cosplay. So I'm just kind of waiting for the belts to get taken off them by somebody other than the club.
Yeah, and for them to probably wind up on main event, which I think is probably going to be their ultimate destination in WWE. We had Becky Lynch out doing a bit of a woe is me promo. She was wearing her Bruce Lee Game of Death top. Asuka came out, started ranting in Japanese. Lynch punched Asuka and left. I thought this was piss poor. I mean, it's just to promote one of the big matches at Royal Rumble, and I'm just less interested in it after this angle, if I'm honest.
I mean, I can't blame you. I get what they're going for, but it just wasn't really that exciting, was it?
No. Mojo Rawley recoiled in terror at the sight of the thing or things that were concealed in the cage that Eric Rowan was carrying around. That was Mojo Rawley's best performance in a while. Actually, no, he did have that match with Kevin Owens. That was pretty good.
Got high praise for Mojo.
We still don't know what's in the cage. We still don't know what's under the sackcloth. Rowan squashed jobber KJ also. Also fled when he saw what was in the cage. I mean, they're building this one up. And I'm trying to work out what it could potentially be that's not going to be a disappointment. And I'm having a hard time coming up with anything. What do you think, Kenny?
It's not looking good, is it?
It's not. We had Charlotte Flair versus Sarah Logan. Once again, Charlotte beat down her opponent. Kind of feels like they're building Charlotte up for something, aren't they? They're building her up for the Royal Rumble, right? So are we supposed to think that she's going to win the Royal Rumble and then face Becky Lynch at WrestleMania? I mean, surely not. But who else have they got that's ready to credibly face and defeat Charlotte Flair? We've talked about this before. They haven't got anyone.
Yeah, they're gonna have to rejig some stuff around because it's just not looking. You can't really do Becky and Charlotte, and then you've got to keep them separate, and they're on the same brand. It's an issue, but we'll probably have an answer coming out of the Royal Rumble what's going to happen. But the big story of the night was obviously Kevin Owens and Samoa Joe having a third partner.
Yeah, I was just going to get to that. I mean, we found out that it wasn't going to be Aleister Black when he faced Shelton Benjamin and defeated him, and then Buddy Murphy ran out to destroy Black. So we're going to get another Murphy versus Black match next week. Which meant that our pick, Aleister Black, was definitely not going to be the third man in the main event. So, Kenny, you know, people probably already know. Well, in fact, I was talking about it earlier. I've already ruined the surprise by mentioning it earlier in the podcast. Mm-hmm. It was Big Show.
You know, you're always going to get a pop for Big Show because he's from an era where wrestling was, like, insanely popular. Which, by the way, Big Show 20 years ago was the worst Big Show. Like, you know, WWF champion Big Show. Ugh. Watching that reign second time is just so horrific. But he got the big pop when he came out, and he has got a cool punch, but it's the Big Show. He's 49. I mean, to me, he should have retired after that Braun Strowman match on Raw a couple of years ago. It was so good.
It was.
And he's out here to do another bow, and that's fine, but it just feels like, could you not put like Aleister Black in this spot? Because it just felt like it was, I just don't feel like the Big Show adds too much at this point.
No, I mean, and we're going to get another match between them next week. A fist fight, I think they're billing it as, right? Because it was a DQ finish.
Yeah.
It was a DQ finish. Seth Rollins, the Monday Night Messiah, he ran in and blasted Show with a chair as he's grabbing the Authors of Pain. Rollins afterwards is nailed with a big Show, big right. Rollins goes down. So and then the heels. In fact, the AOP dragged Rollins up the aisle, didn't they? So like they did with the Owens a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
To me, Big Show, it just felt, yeah, you got that nostalgia pop. But I mean, he just looked knackered to me. He could hardly walk. You could see guys were having to bounce off him and do most of the work because physically he's in a pretty rough shape. I mean, that's fairly obvious. I think did he take the mic after the match and talk about his, I think he talked about his hip operations. I think that's correct, isn't it, Kenny?
Yes.
So that must have been after the show. Was that after the show? Enough the air?
It was a clip online. It wasn't on the actual show.
It wasn't on the programs. So he's talking about all the surgeries he's had, and he looks like he needs both knees doing as well. I mean, he just like, you know, I'm hoping this is going to be extremely short lived. He did actually have that little comeback, didn't he? With was it with Cesaro and Sheamus at Survivor Series? Where there was the spot where Drake Maverick pissed himself. He had a little comeback there, didn't he? That was kind of short-lived.
I feel like you're bringing stuff up and I'm going, it's taken me a minute to even remember this stuff happened, which is not a great sign. what the big show has been up to recently.
I think that was Survivor Series, not last year, the year before, 2018. I think that's right. And he was aligned with Cesaro. Must have been Sheamus, because they were a team at the time.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I remember that briefly. Because they were called the Big Bar.
That's right.
There we go. Good.
That's right.
And he lasted 2 weeks.
The high spot, was it Survivor Series, where Drake Maverick had to piss himself? And the gimmick that they'd given him to do it failed.
I think so.
So he genuinely had to piss himself on camera. I mean, that's the method for you. Well done, Drake. But yeah, it was a pretty flat main event overall. And the fact that we're going to do it again next week in a fist fight, I'm not inspired. I mean, it was right at the end of the show. They had a huge plug for all the matches that are taking place next week. And they had to really rush that plug through. I mean, in recent weeks, the timing at the end of Raw, everything's been rush. And this is very un-WWE-like. I mean, just like the bizarre situation with the referee that we've discussed and with the poor, you know, minister being rugby tackled by security. I mean, it's just bizarre, isn't it, really? So
it's very... I will give them props that they have set up a pretty big show for next week. They've got AJ Styles and Orton, Murphy and Black, the Lashley and Rusev match, the six-man fist fight. So they've advertised a lot, which is good. And Lesnar's going to be there, so, you know, at least they're advertising some stuff, even if it is, you know, hurled at us at 20 words per second at the end.
Yeah. I thought
it was a decent show compared to... You know what I think I liked about it? I liked that the show felt like we're finally starting to see a modicum of direction to something. You know, like, Brock's going to be in the Rumble. Becky's facing Asuka. Drew's getting some steam behind him. Owen's getting some pals to fight Seth and AOP. Like, we're getting somewhere with some stuff. Even if Big Show's not where we want our destination to be, you know, if he's here for a week or two, I'm sure you can endure it, Finn. You've endured worse Big Show runs in your career.
Of course I have. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm here for it regardless. But, I mean, it's only 2 weeks on Sunday, isn't it, Royal Rumble? It's not far off.
We are very close to the Royal Rumble. So, anyway, well, listen, that's it for us. Finn doesn't usually plug it, but you can go to his website, finleymartin.co.uk, to buy his ebooks or see a picture of him.
It's worth the trip.
It's worth the trip. Many people have been back. Finn writes for Wrestle Talk magazine, so you can pick that up in your local WH Smith or online at wrestletalk.bigcartel.com. And as always, you can buy tickets for our upcoming Inside the Ropes shows at insidetheropes.co.uk/tickets to JR and Conrad next month for Grill and JR Live or Kenny Omega coming up in April. So we hope you'll enjoy it. You'll enjoy it or you'll join us. One of the two. Enjoy it and join us. you can also
You'll have to join us to enjoy it.
But you'll have a great time. Then you can also go to youtube.com/insidetheropes. For interview content, get a new clip up there with Mick Foley talking about the 20-year anniversary of his street fight in Madison Square Garden with Triple H, where he says he didn't get the biggest pop of the night. That was reserved for someone else in the Garden at Royal Rumble 2000. And go over there and see who it is he thinks that was. And finally, you can get this podcast 24 hours early and an overrun with us on Patreon at patreon.com/InsideTheRopes. I think that's all the plugs.
I think that's all the plugs, Kenny, yes. So, yeah, Ooh. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we will see you next week.
Bye, everybody. If I be tonight, if I'm sad tonight.